Good day, everyone. This is 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back. I am Mike Nelson.
Hey, Mike. I'm Connor Lestoka. It's great to be here today after the horrible tech issues that plagued the first 35 minutes of trying to get started today.
Yes, we hope that there's not our disappointment in our own technological prowess is not bleeding through the microphones, because I am excited about what is to come. This is the podcast where we are going through the book Armada by Ernest Cline as a follow-up to, well, this podcast is a follow-up to our podcast about his first book, Ready Player One. And we're plowing our way through it, and that word plowing is on purpose. I, though, am excited, Connor. Are you excited or not excited?
Yeah, you know, there's something that's been looming over this the past couple months, and I haven't mentioned it to you until now.
Oh,
I don't know if it's been palpable in the last couple ones we've done, but you know how we finished the last one, and I had that fun idea to, you know, auction the books off for charity.
Yeah,
it worked out pretty well. I mean, some people really stepped up. It was really generous.
I thought that was a good thing.
It was. They sold for like $450, which is great. No, that's raised a lot of money for a good cause. But I don't know if you've sold anything on eBay like recently.
I mean, you know, I've let loose a few things. Why?
Well, they just, so after you sell something for hundreds of dollars, they come through at the end of the month and they debit you for like 10% of that sale.
Yeah.
So I donated all that money to charity, and then they came through and they charged me $45 to sell those books off. You know, so whenever you've got that $22.50 that you want to send my way for that good gesture that went unpunished, that's anytime.
This month is not looking good.
It was the people who we sent that money to actually wrote back, and they were like, "We love Riff Tracks and Mystery Science Theater." So it was actually made it even better to generously donate that money. I'm kidding,
cool.
Of course.
Yeah, that's great. No, that was good. And also, I want to congratulate our fans. This is what sort of propelled me past the irritation of our, this will be, of course, unheard to all of the people listening to this, but 40 minutes of tech frustrations. The thing that got me over that hump and got me past that was that right as I was preparing for the show, I saved for the last the fan fiction that people sent in. So in another area... the listeners stepped up and came through with some spectacular fan fiction. And I was rubbing my palms together thinking these are all going to be severe challenges for my co-host Connor Lestoka on this show.
Yeah, they stepped up. They stepped to the point where, like, I'm not responding to emails anymore. Like, we're getting too many emails.
Wow.
And so I'm not, I mean, I wrote to one guy because I laughed out loud reading his fanfic and was like, Mike is not going to get this. But I'm not, I mean, apologies in advance. Like, I used to try to write back to people. But we got like 45 emails this week, and that's just, a lot of them were fanfic. But we got to set up a better way to do this, either a Google form someone suggested or send them as attachments. Because otherwise, I got to open them up and forward them to you, and I have to like not read them, and that's just not possible. There's no like bulk forward. So fortunately, like three people did, so that's how you got yours this time. But I'll post it on the accounts whenever we figure out what we want to do.
Yeah. So all that is preamble to what we're doing. We are in chapters. What we're like page
4 through 7. Book one is essentially, he does that thing where books, chapters, sections in your book he calls books or whatever. That's always bugged me.
Yeah, well, especially since it's him and it's not, you know, like Tolkien right. or something. Like yes. that. There's not really discernible sections.
Yeah. Chunk of pages one.
Although at one point late in this, when he gets to the end of, and I don't want to spoil anything, but I'll just say he sort of spells out in a hilarious way of what's exactly happening in the book. Like it reads like his notes in the margins. Like, now is the time where I do the thing. Anyway, but I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, let's work our way up to that, because there's a lot we don't want to skip over. Which, you know, let's get right into it. The chapter four starts with with something that someone had sent me before we had like even decided to do this. And they sent me this chapter, excerpt from this chapter where he's talking about his mom. And I was just like, you have made this up, because there is no way that he has gone to this horrible Oedipal well to describe his mom when he gets home from his from school that day or from work.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it bears rereading. Do you have it right there with you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he gets home and he's upset because his mom, who usually works double shifts as a cancer ward nurse. So she's got a heart of gold, but she's also ridiculously beautiful. He says, you know, everyone is supposed to say things like that about their mothers, but in my case, it happened to be a fact. Few young men knew the Oedipal torment of growing up with an insanely hot, perpetually single mom. So he did this in the last thing where the girl, you know, he was obsessed with her avatar as being insanely hot, yet also, you know, great at video games. But now he's gone and done it to his own mom.
And he's done it in a way that you can't just put that out there and then that's just a thing we're all supposed to forget about. You know how there's just
no,
because his mom is a character in it. And then one of the things that he says about her and their relationship is that it is weird that she has to look at him all the time as he starts to look more and more like his own father, her late husband, obviously.
Yes.
What the hell is that? Like, he's going
pretty much
way
describes
overboard.
Himself as a doppelganger and like how she's still so hung up on him, you know, that his sight of him causes her like these horrible pains in her heart to just see him walking around the house, which is all him projecting.
Yeah. And he gives another description to his mother that also cracked me up. She reminded me a lot of Sarah Connor or Ellen Ripley. Sure, she might have a few issues, but she was also the kind of single mom who would strap on heavy artillery and mow down killer cyborgs if that's what it took to protect her offspring. There's another one of his clunky words for himself.
He's been the man who sired me in the last chapter.
The spawn of my mom. But what, she's the type who would, like, and what situations was this, has this ever been tested? Like, what?
Right.
What are you talking about?
And as opposed to most mothers who are indifferent about their children and sort of, you know, that are like, I don't know. If anyone was going to threaten my kid, I don't know if I'd get up from the couch.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine with me. Yeah, the
couch, she's frequently, you know, entering TV marathons. But she has many TV addictions, she says, but she's also described as a workaholic who's working double shifts at the hospital.
And she goes out for drinks and dancing a lot with her friends.
I like that. She just goes out dancing.
She went out dancing all the time when she wasn't working in the cancer war. And it made me think, like, this must be insane when she goes out, because insanely hot. So, right. Like, she's down at the rendezvous bar just dancing. Is this, like, are guys just going bananas and, like, throwing money at her? And
yeah, they're doing the double takes and auga horns, like, in when the Violet walks by and It's a Wonderful Life, you know?
Yeah, so when she's not watching many back-to-back marathons of Say Anything, she's out dancing a lot when she's not working at the cancer ward.
Right. So I thought it would be, I think, I, you know, whether she comes up again, I don't know. But I think if you ever reread this section and every time she's mentioned, just put the word hot in front of every time that they say the word mom, it makes it a lot more fun to read it. My hot mom had never played the part of the lonely widow. Feel like having some breakfast for dinner with your insanely hot mom?
Then she has the serious talk with him, right? And she stops him as he's trying to get up the stairs to his bedroom and says, "You shall not pass," his hot mom declared. And that was really hard for me to do the mental picture of an insanely hot mom doing a Gandalf impression. Was just
right.
Really very jarring.
Right. If she's either going for it, you know, full on Ian McKellen voice, or she's sort of doing like the a hot you know, half-hearted, like, you know, type of, I don't know. It is a crazy mental picture, but fortunately it's one that we get to experience twice, because on the next page, he says, "I tried to slip past her again, but she blocked my path and then stomped her foot down in front of me, pretending like she was Gandalf and I was the Balrog."
Yep.
I meant to rewatch it, but my association with that scene is like him throwing his arms up. I don't know if he's, you know, cutely stomping his foot in that.
I believe he has a couple of staffs, which he smashes on the and makes like a big lightning ball with it. But she also, there's another facet to her too. And this is, try to keep your, you know, my head was snapping around trying to cement my image of this insanely hot mom doing Gandalf.
She's into, she's like one of the preeminent scholars about Donatello, the Renaissance sculptor.
Oh, that is a great guess. Yeah. No, but before, I know what you're leading to, but this is just a line of hers to him. So she's talking to, this is along the lines of her Gandalf impression, which I don't know whether she keeps it going or what, but
right.
You're going to find my foot jammed disturbingly far up your ass if you don't stop screwing around and start making a serious plan for your future, mister. I just wrote, his mom's freaking me out. Like, who is she? Yeah. This insanely hot woman telling she's going to put her foot way up his ass.
Right, which everything he said before leads you to believe, like, you know, all right, like, you know, this is, so that's how it is in their family.
Yes, but no, the overriding trait of his mom is what, Connor?
Well, she's shockingly, his hot mom was a hardcore gamer back in the day. She had a serious World of Warcraft habit for a few years, but she's more of a casual gamer now.
Oh, man. Yep. I guess you could say she's kind of a nerd.
She is. She's what everyone at comic conventions think girls are pretending to be, like that sort of, you know, the hot person who's dressed up like Samus from Metroid or Lara Croft, but who actually like enjoys playing these games. Yes. Doesn't mind if you're not as in shape as she is, because she's, you know, has a thing for nerdy guys.
Totally. Well, it's so weird that he put that in the character of his mom, though. So avoidable.
Yes. But she was discouraged from he sort of gets the backstory of the family. His father's grandparents were these great people. He liked going over to their house and hearing these stories. But his mom's mom, it says her ultra religious mother had disowned her for getting knocked up while she was still a senior in high school, and then marrying the no good Nintendo nerd who defiled her. And so it's another sort of Kleinian. He inserts his disdain for religion into there, but. In the same way, it's another Kleinian touch where he describes these characters who he loathes, but who clearly are the sensible people in this story.
Yeah.
It's like, well, yeah, like she should. This loser who's hanging around at arcades and sending away for patches to put on his leather thing, and, you know, banging a underage girl in high school and then marrying her. Like, his mom is talking sense.
Yes.
He's working at the sewage treatment plant. Like, this is a Bruce Springsteen song, essentially, but with video games.
Oh, man, the sewage treatment plant thing is just such a treat.
But let's get to that. But there's one thing. We've been a little harsh on it. But I think that there are other artists who have done this thing, sort of talking about their hot moms. I found an example of one. This was my sister got married last August, and... there was a really touching moment where her husband, he did the groom and mother of the groom dance like they're before, you know, this sort of reception started. And it was a really touching moment. They danced to this Boys to Men song that I had never heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of caught up in the moment, you know, wiping away tears. But so I didn't really notice the lyrics of it while they were dancing. But like I went back and listened to it after this.
Yeah.
And like they sort of have the same thing going on in this song. So like it might not just be Ernest Cline who's into this sort of thing. I pulled the clip of this song.
All right, let's hear that.
You will always be the girl in my life for all time.
Hot
mama.
Insanely hot
mama.
Ridiculously beautiful,
mama,
in shape,
mama,
even though you spend a lot of time watching TV.
Your love is like tears from the stars.
done.
So let's have sex, mama.
Mama, I just want you to know. Loving you is like food to my soul. Yes, it is.
Yeah, so I guess there's a...
Wow, yeah.
It comes up in other art forms, R&B and geek novels.
That is surprising, but... and the singing was, excuse me,
right.
The singing was spot on. I mean, that was good stuff.
I think that's the deep voice guy in Boyz II Men doing those interjections there.
Yeah, a lot of passion.
But so the thing about his mom, it sort of ends with her giving him the advice about what he needs to do. You know, make some plans for the future. He can't just work at the video game store. But she sort of reveals that she's. I was puzzled about this because she's like, you know, what are you going to do in college? What are you going to do after this? But I think that it's been established that school ends in 2 months. Like
yeah.
he has to,
yeah.
he's supposed to be hang on, just like graduate, don't get arrested, don't beat up this guy. But he has a fully funded college account, which I'm guessing by this point in time is probably like close to $200,000.
Right.
But he has no plans to do this. Like he's just, People were making you apply to college like the first week of senior year of high school, and you were supposed to have visited them by sophomore year. Like, so as she's working doubles at the cancer ward, I was just like, is she sort of just thinking maybe I should be tapping into this since he has no plans to go to college? Like, it didn't add up for me.
No, and also pulling those double shifts at the cancer ward, is she going in a lot, smelling like the places she goes dancing a lot too? That's what I just wonder. I don't know. I guess it would have been maybe after smoking bans, but still there'd be that smell of liquor and
right.
fried foods all over. I mean,
well, the cancer guys are probably just distracted by the hotness of the person who's administering their chemo, I guess.
Yeah. But he says that his or she offers the plan of him being a video game designer, and he says, no, right. I'm not smart enough. I don't know. All I can do is play them. And she says, well, then be one of those video game testers. He's like, no, those guys are losers, man. they don't make any money. And so he's sort of cogitating on that after the fact as he goes in to gear up, to rig up for his big night session with his friends. But he said, I knew Armada was only a video game, but I'd never been one of the best at anything before, and my accomplishment gave me a real sense of pride. Admittedly, all the time I'd had to devote to the game had shaved a full point off my grade average, and it probably cost me my relationship with Ellen, too. I just like that, like, finally there was some little point of self-realization and... maybe, I don't know. And then, nah, he straps on the, on the rig anyway and goes full in.
he is remarkably self-aware in terms of like, my obsession with my father had bordered on the madness for a while. And, he's pulling stuff out and being like, I had built the room as a shrine to him. It's like he's sort of psychoanalyzing himself in these very self-aware terms without doing anything about it or exacting the willpower to make any changes.
Right.
But he also exists in a world, it's a shame that we live in this type of world where someone who's the best in the world at a video game can turn that into a semi-lucrative profession, by streaming.
Yeah, that's why I wondered, he never even mentioned the competitions or anything like that, where you, obviously, these are pro level, these are pro athlete level salaries and things like that. So just play that for money. People do it all the time.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe not going to college is fine, but it's funny that that's not acknowledged. Maybe it was just sort of written before that was mainstream enough.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he goes up to his room in the next chapter, which he says is a shrine to his father's memory with all these models and posters and stuff. But he also it toes that line between it's all stuff his father liked, but he's not just doing it because his father liked it. His entire personality is Star Wars.
Yeah, and he says...
Like he likes it too.
Yeah, and at one point he said he walked into the room and he said it for the first time he was embarrassed by the stuff in his room. And then he proceeds in the next paragraph to list every spaceship that he has hanging from his ceiling by a nylon string or whatever and touches them lovingly.
Right, and then goes on to quote Yoda in his own internal monologue.
Right.
So yeah, self-awareness without taking any action is great. But one of my, I enjoyed that he walked into the room And he's sort of describing things, and most of the things he's describing are just listing the models, like you said. But he goes for broke on one. He says, "Moonlight fell on my battered leather gaming chair, casting it in an otherworldly glow." Which is like, all right, settle down with the otherworldly glow. Like, we've all seen shit at night before. Like, this
gaming machine.
And that gaming chair is always a good phrase.
I'd like to enlist you for what happens next. He logs on and he talks a little bit about, first of all, we do get a list. We're not going to read that list.
Oh, yeah, but yeah, yeah.
We get the high scores at his game, Armada, that he plays. And he talks about the top five guys are these unknown, mysterious, real hot shots, like real top gunners. And they don't play with the rest of the people. They just come in and destroy them. And again, since there's no money to be made here, who knows why? Who knows?
Right.
But he says they're these unknowable people. And one of the things that bugs him is that the top guy, Red Jive, will destroy you. And then when he's done destroying you, he types a message to you. He taunts or he says, "You're welcome." And it's just like gets under his skin. And then he describes what taunts are. Like, and it was probably designed so that it shook you up and then you didn't regenerate. It's like, yeah, what are you talking about?
Right.
When I played Doom back in, 1992, of course we were taunting each other. That's,
right.
That's
and then,
what you do.
And then this is his signature. And then that would somehow get you under the skin every time it happened, that these two words that are very mild that you are expecting if he kills you are somehow doing this great taunt. But he's so obsessed with it that he has his own retort welcome, his own retort prepared, which is...
Yes, this is where I want you to... I have a short play to do here, and I need you to to play the other side of it. So his reply, after all of this talking about how he's getting under his skin, and then one day I will kill him, and then you know what I'm going to say? No, 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 Red Jive, you're welcome. And I thought, this is very much an echo of Over the Top. So I just like to create the scene. Okay. I think you know what I'm talking about. I will be Robert Loggia, the man trying to steal Stallone's son from him, and you be of course Stallone.
Yeah. I've just crashed my truck through the gates of your mansion.
Yes, and I'm at the top of the stairs, shaking my fist. My face is red with rage. That he would do such an outrageous thing and try to take back the son that I've gone to court to fight for.
Right.
And so I say to Sylvester Stallone, I say, "Damn you.
Damn you."
Yes. That is a precise recreation of Stallone's retort.
See the gears turning like in Homer Simpson's head as he gears up to deliver that one.
No, 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 Red Jive. You're welcome.
Yes, Red Jive is like, what? Did a message come in? I quickly moved on from that.
I'm frying a grilled cheese. I didn't actually notice. Yeah. What's happening?
But it's funny. I mean, in this book, he tries to sort of nail the way that a high school gamer would talk to each other. But I thought, I haven't played online video games with high schoolers, but I know what they would be talking like. And the idea that they're taunting each other by saying "you're welcome," or that when the top five has earned the right to sort of colorfully paint their ships, that
yes.
The nickname that the high schoolers have come up for that crew is the Flying Circus, and not like a bunch of stuff that I'm not going to say, like
right.
A bunch of like homophobic slurs is very, very naive of the of this guy. The fact that
and we get, speaking of their online stuff, we get another description of he and the Mikes, whose yes. names are befuddling me. I'm trying to keep track of their online and their offline names. But he said, "We had each customized our avatars so that they vaguely resembled our real selves, only slightly taller, more muscular, and less pale." So once again, we get that thing that my first thought was, were I another player, I would just have had the strong feeling that their avatars looked a lot like themselves.
Right.
Which is a trope of his. Like,
yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, but less pale.
Well, he does spend a lot of time in the otherworldly glow of the gaming chair. So, yeah, his brother, one of his buddies' call signs is Quoth, which is a...
I was too irritated to look it up, yeah.
Yeah, it's I've actually read the books those come from. It's by a guy named Patrick Rothfuss, The Name of the Wind, which, you know, they were more compelling than this. There's a very Kleinian passage in the second book, though, that goes on for like 60 pages, where he is in this in the clutches of this like sexy nymph that he's sort of in a Groundhog Day situation there. He gets lulled into complacency, and the only way out is to bang this nymph so well that she like is able to release him. And I had to log online and see if this was like a gigantic sticking point for anybody else in the story. And it was like this whole thing, this embarrassing wish fulfillment of this guy who's so good at sex that he can work his way out of the situation. So that's my association with that. The books were fine. And they're like, he's sort of doing a George R.R. where he's just, it's unfinished business. Whining and dining and hanging out with people instead of finishing his books. But that's where Kvothe comes from.
And the other guy is Delio.
Yeah.
His last name is Deal.
Yes. Those guys are like, they just sort of are there to be a Greek chorus of shitty nerd arguments.
The mics?
Yes. It's like Stephen A. Smith's First Take, where they're just like shouting at each other about... you know, what you would imagine a stereotypical nerd from 1990 would have been portrayed like in the media.
Yeah, it's really awful.
It's terrible. You know what's even worse is when you listen to the audiobook of it. I've got a little clip of that too.
Oh boy. Oh, I can't wait.
Superheroes don't use swords, Deal said gleefully. What about Nightcrawler? Deadpool? Elektra, Shatterstar, Green Arrow, Hawkeye. Oh, and then there's Blade and Katana, two superheroes who are actually named after swords.
Oh, man.
So when you come to them in the book, I sort of, my eyes just sort of gloss over, and I'm like, okay, yeah, they're going to just start listing stuff. But when you do get a sense of what that would sound like out loud, it's just intolerable.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I'm going to tease it coming up. We got to get through this chapter, but at the end of it, there is a scene that he cut, so we do actually have their voices for the upcoming Armada film. I'm pretty deep in Hollywood, so I have an advanced a version of it, and we get a little more taste of Mike. But I'll save it. Just save it.
All
there.
Right, all right.
Yeah, we'll hold it for later.
They get ready for this. Mission that they're going to run by like watching a long unskippable cutscene, which sort of made me question why this is the most popular game in the world, because this sounds like a kind of a dull way that you have to sit there and watch something every time you want to play the game.
Well, the mics were getting restless with it, but Zach was on board. Why? Because it was the actor who's playing the admiral who briefs them. Here, can I read a short description? Yeah. As the crest faded away, it was replaced by the familiar face of Admiral Archibald Vance, the Earth's Defense Alliance's highest-ranking officer. The actor Karis Chaos Terrain had hired to portray the admiral totally nailed the part. You know how there's actors made for certain roles, like Peter O'Toole with Lawrence of Arabia and Helen Mirren as the queen, and this guy as Admiral Archibald Vance, nails it. Like, that didn't exist already?
He's got, yeah, exactly. He's not like stepping into the role of Hamlet or Macbeth.
Yes.
But and what it sounds like is like, you know, your generic like Michael Ironside kind of guy with he has an eye patch and a scar.
Yep.
Which, like, if you wanted to create a grizzled, you know, veteran army guy, like, that would be, you're one step away from having him like missing an arm or having a hook for a hand in terms of the cliches that you're piling on there.
I wonder how he did with the line, "We're not in Kansas anymore. They'll be eating your eyeballs like juju bees." I bet he nailed that.
Yes. Yeah. Didn't that guy like have a prominent scar in Avatar? Like,
yes. Yeah.
Well, something else that was in that section is them sort of discussing the nature of what they're about to do. And it led to one of the stupidest exchanges I've ever read. They were talking about, so this is the first time they're going to the aliens planet. They've traveled at light speed through 7 years to get there.
Yeah.
And so they're attacking them. He says, the buddy, No, the main guy says, "Hey, interplanetary warfare isn't a team sport," I replied. "Never has been," which is colossally stupid on its face, because it would be the one thing that you would require, like, literally an entire planet to team up and do. And then his buddy corrects him. "Actually, it kind of is, if you think about it." So, touche. Well done, sir.
No, and he damn goes, you.
He goes on to Kleinianly pile on. "The home team versus the visitors. Get it? Visitors?" After a pause, he added, "Because they're aliens?" But it's explicitly stated that this is the first time they've gone to their planet and attacking them. So it's the one time in this game where they haven't been the home team, and they are, in fact, the visitors. It's so sloppy.
Oh, come on. You're calling Klein sloppy? Maybe this little bit of tight humor will get you back in the mood. They describe the underwater thing. They're going to attack something in a subterranean thing and blow them up. And Deal says, "Now I feel bad, like we're about to nuke Aquaman or the Little Mermaid." "Pretend they're both Gungans," Cruz suggested, "and that we get to nuke Jar." They both laughed. So
did they really say Jar? Yeah. Just Jar?
Yeah.
Wow. First name basis.
Yeah.
Right. Again, the bar for humor is set very low in these characters' worlds.
Oh, Mikes, you guys crack me up.
But he in the game, they sort of like march around and then they all strap into their weird little virtual simulation rigs.
We got rigs, Connor.
Yeah. I'm sure that they pay off later, like we talked about last time, but it's a very strange thing that in the video game, their characters are climbing into the virtual reality rig, in order to add some weird layer onto this.
Yeah, there's a sentence here that, and I don't want to skip over the fact that they call each other Leroy Jenkins several times.
Yeah.
That
was just sort of like a deep sigh.
And then in one of his responses, he says, "No, we always get killed because of you, Leroy Jenkins." And this is Zach saying, "I've asked you repeatedly to stop calling me that." I'm like, what, did you just become Bertie Wooster or something? "I've asked you repeatedly to stop referring to me as Leroy Jenkins."
but it's something that he does. Like, it would be if you were the kind of guy who, you know, went to the bar and was like, you know, "Fireball time, brah." And then, you know, if you did that every time we went to the bar, and I'd be like, "Okay, like, let's take it easy tonight, Mr. Fireball time." And it's like, like, that's the thing, you go into the bar and say of your own free will. Like, it's not, I haven't assigned you this nickname derogatorily.
Yes.
Literally words you say every time. Yeah, anyway.
But here's the sentence, speaking of the sort of layers that we have to follow. And I want to bring this to a skilled storyboard artist and have him sketch this out for me. I'll be honest, I didn't spend more than 3 minutes rereading it, but just try to puzzle it out with me, just on its face. Prima facie, here's the sentence. The cutscene ended, and my perspective shifted back to my avatar's POV, only now I was sitting inside my own drone controller pod. A second later, the hatch hissed closed above me just as all of the control panels around me lit up, as did the wraparound view screen. This created a second layer of simulation, the illusion that I was now sitting inside an AD-188 aerospace drone interceptor powered up and waiting in its coiled launch rack in the Doolittle's drone hangar.
Good Lord.
What the shit is going on? He's describing seven layers of reality we're supposed to track within one sentence. We're supposed to picture this. And then in the middle of it, he's got a little Tom Clancy-ish sort of... you know, made up tech that we're supposed to follow. Oh, of course, the ADI-88 aerospace drone interceptor. Right. No, picture, done. Don't say another word, sir.
Yeah, it's every time he's describing something in a video game, I'm left wondering, like, okay, pretend he's talking about Mario Kart here, and like how uninteresting that would be if someone was describing you to the game of Mario Kart they played. But this is also adding on, like, okay, you start Mario Kart, you pick Mario, then it shows Mario walking, getting into the like virtual arcade Mario Kart machine, and then putting the extra layer of like you see Mario's hands holding the steering wheel of the Mario Kart and then the projection of the Mario Kart ring that he's it's so unnecessary and so frustrating. And yeah, even hearing it read out loud like that makes it sound so much worse than it is when you sort of just gloss over it on the page.
Yeah, and there is a lot of it in here. This chapter,
the next chapter is entirely
it is incredible. But there is, I wanted to test you again, Connor, on a on a sentence that cracked me up. They make this attack and they start bombarding whatever the headquarters of the enemy is. And he says the ensuing detonations lit up the view screen like a. So this is a chance for you to, what kind of Kleinian language do you think he used? He's got his opportunity to describe something lighting up in ways that things light up. What do you got? How do you think he finished that sentence?
The the sky on the 4th of July.
No. Get anything else come to mind?
He likes movies. He probably the scene where Roy Hobbs hits the baseball into the lights in The Natural.
I'm sure that's right. I wonder how many back to back viewings he had of that.
maybe he describes it as the Northern Lights. You know, the beauty few people ever get to see in their life of Aurora Borealis.
You are wrong, Camel Breath. No.
One more. I don't know. The opening credits of Manhattan by Woody Allen.
The ensuing detonations lit up the view screen like an old school game of Missile Command.
Yes, of course.
It's like putting on an old slipper.
Which is, you know, one of the that Missile Command is essentially like a kid's drawing of, your six-year-old like being like, it's like lines and circles.
Yeah, yeah. That's the one where there's just like little blocks at the bottom and you fire a little tracer thing.
You click
things.
Where you want it to explode in the sky. It's
wow.
It's not a very visual game. I think that takes us into the chapter 6 where they do this game. But do you want to stop and do some fanfic before that?
Oh, yeah, let's do that. Cause my flow switching, trying to tell me what to write. I bought some fan fiction. Can't they just be happy? I no longer have to face eviction. That I'm living on my life. I'm living on my inner vision right now. Oh, I'm excited.
Very excited.
Yes. All right. So explain the premise here. I think it's pretty simple, but go ahead while I get my papers in order.
Well, we've got the premise is that Ernest Cline's work is indistinguishable from fan fiction of Ernest Cline's work. Or at this point in time, we've asked all you guys to write in it. So none of you are really fans. So it's more of like the parody, the exaggerated badness of the fan fiction is indistinguishable from something that might actually be in one of these books.
Yeah, you know, the Ernest Hemingway competition every year is entertaining. You know, write prose like Cline is not a tough challenge, but there is a particular thing, and some people really, they latch onto it. And the samples that I got, all the people knocked it out of the park for me. I laughed out loud. So
nice.
Yeah, they didn't try to gild the lily too much. They like stayed right in the lane. It was perfect.
I will. I'll go first.
Okay, I'm ready.
I'm going to read you. I've got four. The bridge of the Sobrukai Glaive looked just like it did in Armada. The game designers were big fans of Star Trek: The Next Generation, so the layout and decor were pretty similar. One exception was the forward window, which had a circular pattern reminiscent of the Millennium Falcon. The game had prepared me for all of that. What it hadn't prepared me for was seeing my own mother in the captain's chair. Like Marty McFly would say, this was heavy.
Oh, man. Oh, okay. Go on to the next one, and I'll rate them. I'll think on that.
Okay. This was your first and only warning, the Admiral said. You screw up like this again, you'll be flying a cargo plane full of rubber dog shit out of Hong Kong. I stared at him in surprise. He glared at me for several seconds, then gave me an almost imperceptible smile. I suddenly realized who I was talking to. Admiral Vance was also Viper, the Armada pilot currently in fourth place just above Rostam. Viper was also the name of a character in Top Gun, the film he'd just quoted.
Oh, man. That's okay. Keep going. That's perfect.
All right. The screen faded to black, and I raised the visor of my VR headset, taking in the gloomy faces of the other EDA pilots. 23 kills in 3 minutes, I laughed, flipping Iceman the bird. Guess you better go back to shooting womp rats. It's your stupid Leroy move, he shot back. It doesn't take any skill. But it pays the bills, I said, basking in the glow of my name at the top of the scoreboard. This meant I would be able to select the color of my drones for the next mission. I had it all picked out. Red and gold, just like Iron Man. My heavy boots of lead would fill my victims full of dread.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, people have got it. All right. One more.
The guards escorted us to a labyrinthian series of quarters and rooms filled with snaking cables and power lines and crammed to the ceiling with strange machinery whose purpose or function I couldn't even begin to guess. I halfway expected to see a watermelon clamped into a hydraulic press, a la the one in the basement of the Banzai Institute. Unfortunately, the tour remained disappointingly melon-free, although as we plunged through one too many doorways, I did have to resist the urge to give a trademark spinal tap, "Hello, Cleveland!" shout-out. One of the highlights of my existence had been learning that as pilots, we would each be issued a sidearm. Our next stop was in a room labeled Armory. Once inside, our guide told us that the military sentry behind a plane of mesh-embedded glass that we were to receive our gear. We'd already heard the lecture that the sidearms would be a weapon of last resort, that if we were ever in a position to use them, we were dead already. But as it was issued, I was delighted to see that my weapon was an almost exact duplicate of the blasters wielded by the Sandmen, the enforcers in the classic film Logan's Run, a tale of dystopian future where the inhabitants of a doomed city lead an idyllic life, with the caveat that everyone was snuffed out at the age of 30. Given the immediate threat, I doubted I'd live to see 30 anyway, so I gladly strapped on the proffered gun belt.
Wow. Tour de force, all of them.
Really impressive.
I have my guess.
Okay.
I think that only the last selection was from Klein.
All right. Well, that is incorrect. That was a fan pick. I told the guy who wrote that one in, Paul, I told him that I thought it was really good, but I thought at the end the word proffered, I thought, would be the giveaway there, because that is not one I expected to see in his repertoire. But yeah, what is the Banzai Institute?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, Buckaroo Banzai. Okay. So that's where some of those computer names came for. But yeah, so that was fanfic. Any guess which one? There's only one real one here. Any guess of the other ones it was? Iron Man, Victims Full of Dread, as Marty McFly would say, This Was Heavy, or Top Gun was the film he just quoted.
Oh, none of them. They can't be real. I don't know. I'm throwing up my
hand.
The
real one is... Viper was also the name of the character in Top Gun,
the film
he just quoted.
No way.
And I guess the flying a cargo plane full of rubber dog shit out of Hong Kong is a quote from Top Gun. I recognize that.
Yeah, that's that absurd. You know, he's got them down in the room berating them, and they're all covered in sweat and everything. And yeah.
But yeah, so well done, everybody. They were spot on. I laughed out loud at the just like Iron Man. My heavy boots full of lead would fill my victims full of dread.
Yes. All right, you ready for your challenge?
I am eagerly.
Mine are a little briefer. This is number one. He furtively fingered at his bejeweled NES controller and cursed his own stupidity. That was a rookie mistake. Now he had only one life left, and looking at his score compared to Jabbo's, he would need to destroy at least 6 more waves of alien ships. 5, if he could pull off a perfect bonus round wave.
Good Lord.
All right, that's one.
Bejeweled NES controller.
I like your style, Admiral, he said, taking notice of the freshly embroidered rank stripes on my standard issue EDA uniform. Tell you what, the next round of Ecto Cooler is on me.
I think that's a little too heavy, folks.
This is number 3. For thousands of years, the swastika had been used by peaceful cultures around the world
as both an ornamental symbol
and a good luck charm, until it was adopted by the Nazi Party in 1920, and the atrocities they subsequently committed forever transformed it into an icon of humanity at its absolute worst.
Wait, was the swastika? Oh, yeah, I guess it was transformed in. Oh, yeah, it was transformed at some point.
That was number 3.
That cannot be.
That was number 3. This is number 4. He sighed wearily and replied in a tone that can only be described as despondent. I don't know. I suppose I can try. Do or do not, there is no try, I said, putting on my best Yoda voice. My father was a fool for a Star Wars joke, especially from the original canonical films. The Spock-like arch of his raised eyebrow and the Snake Plissken lift of his lip into a smirk made me hold out hope that maybe my dad wasn't as broken and despondent as I was afraid he was.
Oh... Oh, man, they're good. I think that the Ecto Cooler has to be fake. I think, oh, man, That one at the end is projecting that he's going to meet his father. I think it has to be fanfic. Just the three things in a row, Snake Plissken, Spock, and Star Trek. I think that the swastika one might be real just because it's so out of line. And the fact that I think it's real does not, I don't know how that's going to be worked into the story, but that's my guess.
What did you say about Bejeweled NES controller?
Bejeweled NES, I'd say fanfic.
Nicely done.
Really?
That was the swastika's the only real one.
Wow. How does that have any business in this book?
He's getting a briefing. It goes, oh man, I only went a little bit into it. There's stuff about Carl Sagan hiding the secrets of, it's conspiracy theory stuff. It's weird.
Oh, wow.
But
oh, man.
This is the one that, hey, do we want to say the names of these people, or did explicitly say that we should? Because I wanted to give them credit. The one that made me laugh out loud, someone named Kelly Anderson, the first sentence of, he sighed wearily and replied in a tone that can only be described as despondent, I thought was beautiful. Yeah. That was Kelly Anderson.
I wanted to note that. I thought that that could only be described as was... Yes.
Milo Price wrote the Ecto Cooler one, and I chose that as the outrageous sample. I probably could have fooled you with different stuff of his, but I thought, I'll go for the heightened stuff.
But that isn't that ridiculous.
No, it's not ridiculous.
It's just easily a way that could be in there. Like, you know, if I just think that the fact that the swastika one was devoid of the things, it would be so strange if someone had written that as fan fiction. Maybe
it's true. It was a bit of a misdirection. And then Paul Jeffrey wrote the Bejeweled NES controller thing. Perfectly
nice.
Toned. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well
so,
done, everyone.
The Iron Man Heavy Boots Full of Lead was Jordan. Martina wrote the one, seeing my mother in the captain's chair, like Marty McFly would say, this was heavy. And Paul wrote the one that tricked you, the... Logan's Run and
nice.
Proffered Gun Belt.
Nice.
Yeah. Wow, fun. So, yeah, keep them sending. We still have a lot. I've got another one in there I didn't even read. I'll save it for next time. But, that's really well done, people.
Yeah, excellent. All right, we move into the deep, deep heart of the gameplay itself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Boy. We probably don't even need to spend as much time on this. Just pull out the highlights because it is wow.
Yeah. So, like I said, it's just the difference between, I know that I'm reading a book that's fiction, but the fact that he's describing it, and I know this is going to, you know, pay off later,
yes.
But the fact that you're reading about someone playing a video game that has no bearing on anything is like the difference between, you know, if I talked to you about the Super Bowl and I was saying, you know, if you hadn't seen it, I'd be like, oh, it was really dramatic. They did this awesome trick play where the quarterback caught a pass, like, and you'd be like, oh, that's crazy that actually happened. But if I was telling you about my fantasy football league or a game of Tecmo Bowl, you'd be like, stop talking. I don't want to hear about this because it just didn't actually – there's that difference between describing what's essentially the same thing and one of them has happened and one hasn't.
Yeah, I mean it's into someone with a deep description of their dream territory where you're just like,
yeah,
oh, my
exactly.
God, please shut up. I know it's playing like a movie in your head. I can't see it and I don't care. And like you say, zero consequences. It's not real. It's just so – stop.
But there are some good things to note. First of all, is that he continues the Kleinian tradition of having a wildly annoying sort of clippy Alexa type of assistant in his ship that he's opted to have be this one. And his is Flight of the Navigator, made his ship's voice sound like Pee Wee Herman yelling through a vocoder. But this amused me. Like we said last time, you know. Within 30 seconds of trying it, like I remember the first time I got Waze, you could have like Mr. T or Stephen Colbert give your directions as you're driving. And it was try that. All right. Well, that was annoying immediately. So let's just have it be in the standard computer voice that's engineered to be as neutral as possible.
Yeah, but they plunge into this battle. And this is where we learn a little bit more about the mics. Again, how are you loving the mics?
It's hard to pick which one I like better. The mics piss me off every single time they open their mouths.
So Delio cries out as his battle cry, cry havoc, and then nobody responds. So he says, oh, why didn't either of you cry havoc with me just now, he asked. You bitches best be crying me some havoc. You want to jinx us? Sorry, Delio, I said. Then, as loud as I could, I shouted, cry havoc. I'm leaving the crying to you guys, Cruz said, before muttering his own personal pre-throwdown mantra to himself, let's do this. I was filled with rage at that point.
Yes, that's a great thing that he's workshopped there. I bet that the let's do this merchandise is going to fly off the shelves. But the other guy crying havoc, I don't, you know, again, how did this enter into their sphere? Like, what terrible superhero movie used cry havoc and let slip the hounds of war from Mark Antony's speech? Like,
yes, exactly.
How is it entered to their sphere? But yeah, the you bitches better be crying me some havoc, and tied into the when he interrupted their stupid sword thing earlier by saying, sorry to interrupt, ladies. And it's hilarious that you know he again, gamers use much, much worse language and things to insult each other. But it was funny to me that this guy, who undoubtedly is the sort of ally, nice guy to the geek universe, is making his characters talk this way. That's like, you know, alienating to half of his potential audience. It's kind of
yeah, exactly.
Tone deaf.
But here's an interesting thing. I don't have much for the actual gameplay because I really was just trying to follow it. But when the mission is over, we get a description of the mics. They fail at their mission, right? Is there anything? Do you have anything of interest in the? They just fail. Something.
They had their digital deaths, which, you know, in Ready Player One, there were consequences. In this, they don't even actually digitally die.
Right.
They go back in a queue and, like, you know, wait to respawn.
But they can't play it again or something was the stakes. Like, oh, it's not, we can't try again.
Yeah, it was sort of like one of those games like Candy Crush where you can pay probably to get in earlier, but it makes you wait again before you can play it, which, again, is an impediment to this game becoming as popular as it is.
Yeah. But so the mission is over, they failed, and there's this curious sentence, and I looked into this after I read it because, you'll understand. After, the mics tried to cajole me into joining them for a Terra Firma mission, but I mumbled something about having homework, and I said I'd see them at school tomorrow.
Okay.
So up to this point, we'd gotten pretty rich picture of how they speak to each other, yes. And this we just get a toss-off, they tried to cajole me. And I was like, I wanted to hear them cajole him into playing another mission. And after their failure and everything, I'm sure there was some gold in there. And then him demurring and everything, we should have heard that.
Something about homework. Yeah.
So I got in touch with some people that I know and who are developing the Armada script into a movie. And amazingly, they were able to send me. This is fleshed out in the script. This was hacked back by the editor, probably just for time in this book. But it does exist, and it is as rich as I thought. And so
wild. I mean, the Ready Player One movie isn't already out. That's crazy that they're already so far.
Well, you got to get ahead of this stuff. You know,
I suppose
synergy and all of that.
What do I know? I'm not.
Yeah, one a year releases, just like Star Wars. You got it. You know, they're working on this stuff 24/7. So anyway, they you know, I signed a little agreement that I wouldn't do anything else but play this little clip on the podcast. So here it is. This is the Mike's cajoling Zach. Well, our mission failed. Throw that on the failure of my life, I guess. Fatherless, no prospects in life, rage issues. You know what? I'm going to turn in, guys. Good night.
What if Princess Leia had farted on Jabba the Hutt's head?
Yeah, but while she was farting, her boob popped out.
Yeah, Zach. Hey, Zach, what about that?
Oh, guys. Man, that is sweet. And I know you're only trying to help, but I think I just want to be alone in my misery.
Yeah, wants to be alone so we can crawl into a tauntaun and slap the lightsaber.
Yeah, begun the touching of his own glaive has.
Oh, God, you guys are the best. You know, since my father was killed in that explosion at the sewage treatment plant, the two of you have really been my rock.
Here's a screenshot of my rock.
What do you... Oh, there it is. A low-res JPEG of your scrotum poking through a leg of your gym shorts.
Yep.
I am truly blessed to have such friends. Oh, Cruz. And Deal.
Wonder Woman's naked butt.
My cup runneth over. Well, I'd best be turning in.
Zach, wait.
Yes, Delio?
We joke, but I hope you know that, well...
Delio, may I?
Oh, please. Your elegance far outshines mine.
Zach, our joking and jesting, Dee and I want you to know, it's but a thin cover for the deep affection we have for you.
Yes, you both lead and sustain us. You are our friend.
And our brother.
Guys, thank you. Thank you both. As you know, Aristotle called philia the deep love of brothers and friends.
I'm going to stop you right there. Jar Jar sucks.
Yeah. And when is your insanely hot mom going to flash us her rancor pit?
Oh, we laugh, but you heal me. And so to bed, friends.
Yeah, to bed with me.
Fart. Fart. I love you so much.
Wow.
Wow. Yes.
It's a touching little relationship they're building up. It really is.
They're not Ernest Cline. They've done their homework.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So,
I like these clips. I mean, this Hollywood is usually so protective. I'm glad they're taking exception for our little podcast.
Yeah, I think they're opening up the world a little bit. I think that's nice when they interact with their fans. I mean, I think we're the number one Ernest Cline podcast.
I guess they're sort of probably using this as using us, really.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
Well, something that I wanted to note just as we're doing this is his, because he's, like everything, he doesn't just say it once and sort of let you infer things. He wants to lay it on really thick, but he's really emphasizing that the father's mixtape of the arcade antics or something. Arcade, what was it? Who cares?
Yeah.
But his father's arcade mixtape of 80s classic rock hits are very necessary to his success in the game. He's saying Raid the Arcade. Trying to play without my Raid the Arcade playlist in the background invariably threw off my aim and rhythm. And then he later says that the machine gun beat of Another One Bites the Dust was a perfect match for the timing and rhythm of the enemy ships in nearly every kind of mission. And so he's sort of going out of his way to be like, I hope that this tape never goes missing because this would really screw up the my ability. It's like the magic ballet shoes type of story.
Yes.
And he's going to have it in himself all along. But I thought it was funny, just, you know, he emphasizes how much it times out to this thing. And he says that enemy ships sometimes move like a flock of birds. Other times they made sharp turns in the sky like a school of predatory fish. But there was always a pattern to it. And so the pattern of these things is always a generic 4/4 rock song at 100 beats per minute.
Right.
Like, it just means that they're moving in very predictable generic terms up there.
Yes.
So. I looked it up. Another One Bites the Dust is so tap your foot type of thing that it's a song that paramedics use for CPR.
Oh yeah, I heard that. Yeah, that's
they
right.
do that. So that's a it's the most basic song in terms of tapping out a rhythm.
Right. Hey, it's essential to him, and he did have to point out that it was his analog. He said at the beginning he had some clunky term to make sure that everyone knew that it was analog, man.
And then his friend says, you know, he should be listening to Kids Bop, and so I'm glad that's still a common reference. But yeah, so then the game ends. He goes to bed, and you know, he has his terrifying nightmare. The way these chapters ends are always these sort of dramatic dun 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 things, and they're very clunky in every chapter that we read during this section. Just as a note, he does not do dramatic well.
No, not at all.
But he wakes up to see that his car has been keyed, and I thought that, but, you know, he assumes it's the bad guy. But he says, so his car is in his driveway. He says, it occurred to me he had probably done this last night while the Omni was parked outside Starbase Ace, which I thought was I don't know why he assumed that the guy just hadn't come to his house and do it. Like, it was a strange assumption he made, since, as has been well established, he does not live very far from his school.
Yes. And then he goes on to even negate that by saying, but it really wasn't all that noticeable because it's a piece of crap. So he's like, so he went out of his way to say, I don't know why I wouldn't have noticed this. It must have been done in undercover of night at this other place. But in the end, it really was hard to tell that it was even there. Like, what? Yeah. What? It was so Kleinian.
And let this, yet this, you know, moderate thing to his 1980s car, like a 20 something year old car,
right,
has driven him into like a murderous rage. Like, yeah, he takes out a tire iron to go and attack the guy. But not before he tries to calm himself with Yoda, which he says sounds nothing like Fozzie Bear, damn you.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it's a little. I always thought Yoda sounded like Grover, but that's just me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so he gets his tire iron and puts him in his backpack. So he's psychotic. Like, we didn't really talk about that incident, but he blacks out and pretty much does the, you know, stop, he's already dead beating of this guy.
Yeah, which he describes that in a way. I think I have a note about that. He does his, you know, Ralphie from Christmas yes. Story. And he talks about this incident a couple times in an ominous way and then says, oh, and the incident, this was the incident. And then he describes pretty much exactly what I had imagined. I mean, he yeah. implied it before. So I really, why did we have to get a big description yeah. of this thing that was completely implicit in everything that he said? Like, yeah, he hates him because of an incident that occurred before.
Right, he teased that.
Yeah, I did not understand the revealing of that in that particular place. It really had no impact whatsoever, and it was exactly as I thought it was already.
Something else, this is something that a listener named Trevor pointed out. He was the incident occurred because his dad, he mocked his dad's death. He sort of describes as a true Klein protagonist, he has his father's obituary memorized.
Yes.
Yeah. But he's reading it, or he's telling us what it was. You know, he died in the sewage treatment accident. But as he's reciting it back, it's interrupted. It cuts off at funeral arrangements by his mom yeah. saying, are you even listening to me right now, Zach? So it's his clunky. He's standing there zoning out, you know, memorized right. obituary being recited in his own head. But then it's interrupted by his mom doing that. It was like there's no reason it shouldn't just be put there in its own completion. I don't.
By the way, this is the description of when he was taunted into that murderous rage. It says, hey, mm-hmm. Lightman, is it true your old man was dumb enough to die in a shit factory explosion?
Yeah.
And then this is Zach again. I'm not paraphrasing. That's a direct quote. There were eyewitnesses. I just made the note. Okay. No one's doubting that bone mo was anything other than authentic. Calm down. Who's? I'm not kidding you, man.
Did anyone see this? Like, this had not been proven to be an unreliable narrator at this point.
It's but so hey, strange. Listen,
so that's the first thing he said. But then when he shows up at school this time, Notcher says to him, you're in deep shit now, Lightman. Kind of like your old man. And I was like, all right, he's been workshopping his quips here. Yeah. I'm like, that's not a bad one. And yeah. Notcher, I thought, was a great name for a dumbass character. It reminded me of when we were watching the World Series a couple years ago, and we had Schwarber and your tennis player Stosur, and they
Stosur.
Were both Stosur, Schwarber, and Notcher are the dumbass party animals from the fraternity. Like, that, you know, everyone pumped as soon as they entered the party. Notcher's here, man.
Oh, and he brought Stosur.
But so I was impressed by that. But he's got his goons, the Lennies.
Yeah, the Lennies. They're tight contenders for the mics for my affections.
Yes. It was, which are based on another highbrow literary reference that he's sort of just.
You mean the Lennies are?
Yeah.
Well, you mean Lenny from Of Mice and Men?
Of Mice and Men. Yeah.
Oh, the Lenny. Oh, does he say that's why he calls them
yes,
the Lennies?
I mean, he doesn't just leave that to his own devices and let us infer that.
Okay.
But yeah, so he's slipping these things in there. And those aren't the only references that are about to come up, because we got to a page here where in the span of one page he references six things. And they were just so out of the wheelhouse of like things that his father would have liked. Or things that he would have liked. Like, his father was my age. I think his father was probably 35 or 36 when he when he died. But he references Vanilla Sky with
yes.
Tom Cruise.
Yep.
which his father would have been dead. And he, I don't think 18-year-olds these days are going back to that classic Cameron Crowe movie. And then he references The Matrix and The Twilight Zone. He does an amazing thing where he says, he's describing the ship appearing. It looked like some new kind of military aircraft.
Yes.
Okay. A slightly futuristic cross between a helicopter and a Harrier jet.
Got it.
Okay. Like the drop ships in Avatar or Edge of Tomorrow, which is piling them on. And then the next paragraph, he says everyone's sort of pointing at him. And he says it was like that scene in The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And those things all came in the span of probably five paragraphs. And it's just, I don't understand how anyone that was editing this was like, don't put these in here. Like you've set the scene. You're describing it. It's so strange. It doesn't fit in with the character at all. Like he hasn't seen some of those movies. They're all, some of them are, Twilight Zone is 60 years old. Like, brother.
Yeah. And he, this is what puzzled me. I had the exact same notes, the Vanilla Sky. And then pretty much the identical thing about the drop ships. Like what? Avatar or Edge of Tomorrow? Do I get to pick one? And do I mesh it with the description that I already have in my head of the helicopter and the Harrier jet? Like, how? Which one do I use? How does it work?
And neither of those are like The Matrix, where it's something that everyone's familiar with, and we can all be like, oh, sure. Like, if he's dressed like a Harrier of The Matrix, we all know that. The Edge of Tomorrow? That's a cultural touchstone here? Or?
But then he describes, so the ship comes down, the guys get out, they looked like Secret Service agents, he said. And at that point, I'm like, I'm not familiar. Which movie are they in? I mean, I know what Secret Service agents are, but I need that qualifier. Like, are from Avatar or Edge of Tomorrow? What? Come on. Which Secret Service agents?
Yes. But one of the Secret Service agents is his buddy Ray, his former father figure, who is now has been working for these guys all along.
He was surprised when he saw him. You know how I know he was surprised? Because when he took off his sunglasses, I heard myself gasp. Not I gasped. I heard myself and went, hey, I just gasped.
Right. And is Ray, like, is it really that sort of thing, like where he's looking at him and then he does a Clark Kent and takes off his sunglasses and he looks completely different? Like,
I think that's what he's implying, yeah.
Because Ray was implied to look like, you know, the comic book guy with this, you know, sort of fat guy with a ponytail. So it's not like he's not like he all of a sudden looks like
suddenly,
you know,
he's
a movie star.
Yeah, he's a hardened military dude coming down. Yeah. It's bizarre.
But he gets furious with Ray. His anger with this deception is overshadows just about every emotion here, which is that he's now on a spaceship and that spaceships are real and that this video game is real. But he somehow is angry at Ray for lying to him all these years, even though there's clearly bigger things at stake here.
Yeah, and I was puzzled by he goes through the repeat beat of seeing the spaceships and going, oh man, what's going on? I'm crazy. Like, this already happened to you. This is just a repeat of what had already, this was the opening of the book that just got forgotten while you went and played video games. Instead of trying to like chase this down and figure out what is going on, he just goes about his life. So when it happens again, why is he surprised?
Yeah. But Ray drops some good reveals. He trots out the, 17-year-old, all your base are belong to us reference. I'm not sure if you recognize that, but when he says, someone set us up the bomb, time to take off every zig for great justice, that's what that is.
Oh, this is, I had this infuriates me, enrages me. What is that? I looked it up. I couldn't even find what that was in reference to.
Well, so I remember it from my sophomore year of college. It was an original meme where people would sort of like, take this broken English phrase mistranslation from an old, I think, Genesis game called Zero Wing, which was all your base are belong to us.
I know that one. That's kind of the star quote, right?
And then. But then later in it, it says someone set us up the bomb. Time to take off every zig for great justice. So it's just sort of this, badly translated thing. And then people photoshopped that into all these different images. And I remember, we saw this, someone made a video of them to an all your base song. And I remember like showing it to one of our neighbors, this girl who had no idea what she was watching. And she watched this whole 5-minute video, sort of staring at it blankly. And it was just like, So what is all your base or belong to us? Like, why did you show this to me? Like, what? I'm going home. Like, this is
everyone so just the, a little sadder after that.
Yes, it was. It's like, oh, well, I guess that didn't go over as well as it did when me and my buddies watched it. But yeah, so then he drops that reference, and then he drops something that goes over just as well, which is he's sort of questioning the Sober Kai are real. They're real, but we made up all the names for them and stuff. Because the Sober Kai is actually a play on the word sobriquet.
Yes.
Which is actually just a fancy term for nickname. Sneaky, huh?
Yeah.
And like,
that enraged me too.
That I pretty much had the same reaction to my neighbor Kelly in that one, just being like, why are you telling me this? I wish I didn't. Can I go home now?
Like, yes. Oh, and then, so I was fuming at that point. And then, hold on, you're telling me that Star Wars was secretly financed by the Earth Defense Alliance to serve as anti-alien propaganda?
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So, billions of dollars have been sunk into this. They've also controlled the whole video game industry. And it was all for anti-alien propaganda. You know, I guess like the likes of, you know, Starship Troopers type of thing, or but it's just such a roundabout, ineffective, destined to fail plan, instead of just putting up things like, hey, like, you know, a good Indian is a dead Indian type of thing, which the government has proven adept at doing. People are more than willing to eat it up.
It doesn't make, there's no way you can wedge that into making any sense at all.
Yeah, because so Star Wars, again, this is probably the eighth time he's mentioned Star Wars in these 45 pages. The thing that he enthuses about more than anything, the thing that people have devoted their lives to parsing the minutia of, that's supposed to make us anti the people in this movie. Like, we're supposed to like not want to. I mean, people would live in that world. People have their weddings are Star Wars theme, and it was supposed to make us anti-aliens.
Which aliens? Just any alien?
I don't know. Like the evil people in Star Wars are human. Like, yeah. Anakin Skywalker is a person. People are, you know, going to bed clutching their Chewbacca dolls at night. Like, it's not a. it is a baffling. Idea that the government would do this, and it is baffling that he chose Star Wars. I mean, he only picked that because it's obviously his most popular thing. It's his beloved thing, but it makes no sense for that to be the thing people used. Like,
well, if had that been followed up, his question been followed up by, yes, it was, but it was a terrible idea. It was had zero effect. It was from stem to stern. It was an utter and complete failure.
It was the Ford administration's greatest shame.
Oh, yes. Why we attempted it? It is a colossal failure on every single level. But right. But yes.
And so it made no sense. So like, was the. When sci-fi movies were being produced, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers or The Day the Earth Stood Still, like all of that, that was Hollywood on its own. So the government had no involvement in that. They just sort of like then were sort of like, keep making the movies. Here's billions of dollars. Hollywood's like, whoa, cool. We would have easily yeah. made this stuff on our own. Like, you know, we clearly these were popular movies and popular themes. A gigantic hole. In a very tenuous plot, so to speak of, if you want to call it that.
Yes, and then it comes about that his friend, well, his boss and friend, who he occasionally hugs when he gets gifts from, and then he says he's his father, another bit of self-awareness, he said, and obviously my father figure or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, I marked that too, and I was like, did he, I didn't want to go back and look if he said that initially, but like, again, you're a senior in high school. Like, nobody has that sort of level of psychoanalysis, especially with things that are the type of things you'd be unaware of.
Yeah, but that it's not his real name. His real name is Raymond Habishaw.
Habishaw, yes.
I don't know that, but he borrowed Wierzbowski from one of the colonial Marines in Aliens.
Yes.
But this, like... So is the other one also a a reference? Is Habesha?
Well, I just think that he told him that it was a coincidence when he revealed that thing from Aliens. And that just reminded me of a passage I had highlighted earlier where he describes a ship in the video game. Its design reminded me of a little of the Sulaco from Aliens. And it's like, nothing in this book is a little anything. Like, why? Just yes. In other things, he's clearly said it looked exactly like the ship from Aliens. Like, to hedge there is just such a weird, lazy, stupid thing. But yes, Habesha, Mike.
Yeah.
It doesn't ring a bell. It remind, I, for some reason, it was ingrained in my mind. You might remember from the previous book, because it's the brand name of the Habesha immersion rig.
Oh, crap. We're in the Kleinverse.
Yes, this Kleinverse is heavy. And so I think when I looked that up, because I was like, oh, this is obviously just some garbage reference, the only thing I found was a reference to this character in this book. So I think it just must be his own thing. But he is the namesake of the one we're all fan of the hell of a rig from Ready Player One.
Wow. Well, so there that was, it is.
A delightful little Easter egg.
And so the circle closes. Now, what his nom de plume reminded me, well, I guess not a nom de plume, but his handle here reminded me, there was a comedian who used to work open stages when I was doing stand-up comedy, who his name was Bob Sissel, and I thought it was always just sort of and he was a kind of a nerdy, it was sort of a quasi Pee-wee Herman thing, and his name, you know, Bob Sissel is coming up next, and I thought it was curious. And then one day someone told me, did you know that his name is actually like Jay Johnson or something? It was a completely pointless, it didn't convey anything. He wasn't trying to disguise his own thing, but someone said, yeah, he thinks it's really funny that his name is Bob Sissel and not Ray Johnson. And everyone just went, I don't get it.
Yeah.
Like, he's not, no, there is nothing to get. He just thinks it's, he thinks
he
it's
didn't
better.
A cool name like Tom Cruise. No. He didn't go full like Carrot Top. He's not, you know, being a one namer like Monique or
Detta
from Parks and Rec.
It was a complete lateral move. And and everyone thought that was his actual name. Like, there's the big reveal. Oh, okay. Great.
It's not Aliens. It's just the name of a popular rig manufacturer in Player One. Well, that takes us through the end of that.
That was a slog.
That was a slog. The video game stuff, the description is just very difficult for me to, like I've said, very difficult to not just sort of want to start flipping pages.
Yeah, hopefully actual, you know, being in the world, I don't know, maybe there's some slim hope that he's better at describing things when it is actually happening. I don't know.
We will see. We will see. But let's do some dumb sentences.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is big, big, big. A sentence ends with a period.
All right. I think we get the idea. Let's see what Klein has to offer.
Yes. Well, we've got a couple good ones that people have sent in. People have touched on stuff like we have already touched on the doubling down on the Gandalf impression. The bitches better be crying me some havoc. Here's a good one. Janelle sent this one in. As usual, the alien invaders' tactics didn't make a whole lot of sense. And as usual, I didn't care. Which is he has memorized the patterns. He knows they all sync up to Another One Bites the Dust. But as usual, it didn't make a whole lot of sense. And the video game that he spends his entire time thinking about and playing to the detriment of his social life and grades, he doesn't care about stuff that happens in it. Here's a good one. Your mission is to keep the icebreaker operational for approximately 3 minutes, just long enough for it to melt through the ice and launch its warheads into the planet's subsurface ocean, destroying the enemy's underwater lair, an aquatic hive located on the ocean floor. So keep that in mind as we move, I think, a few sentences later. The tactical animation showed our drone fighters handily defending the icebreaker from the enraged enemy, Armada, just long enough for it to finish melting its giant hull and launch its warheads through it into the planet's subsurface ocean. At this point, the ICBMs transformed into guided nuclear torpedoes, which quickly homed in on the Sobru Kai's underwater cave city, which looked like a high-tech hive built into the ocean's rocky floor. Tell them what you're going to show them, and then tell them what you're showing them.
Man. Yeah.
A video game cutscene.
Yeah, that's where it gets rough. Oof.
Well, I found one that I was particularly fond of. And I was conscious of this because I said the word literally, I think, twice during this podcast. But this one takes the you know, the casual use of the word literally to a whole new level. It's during the briefing that the eye patch scar guy is giving them. He says that tonight we're finally going to hit them where they live, literally. Which there's no, it's not like, you know, in wrestling, like, oh, he just murdered him. Or where it's like, wait, you know, it's like, there's no other interpretation if we're going to hit them where they live. It's just,
yeah,
there's no like exaggeration that you would ever say that for. It purely just means like, yep, nope, yeah, we are. We're going to their planet. That's been established. It was just a, to use the word literally is for comedic effect. I have no objection to that, but to use it here, it was just over the top, not knowing how people speak.
Yep. I noted that as well. I didn't make my sentence. I just have two quick runners up for dumb sentence. Shit, I heard Deal shout over the comm. I just lost my Gorum shields because I'm already out of fracking power.
Yes.
But that's just irritating on its face. I mean, that's, you know, dumb because it's dumb. But yeah. And then another one was, he unleashed a colorful stream of profanity on his comm and logged out of the game completely. And again, like, I don't leave out the color.
Yes.
Tell me what that color was. Stop saying, you know, all this other garbage that you're leaving in there. Cut right, that out and put the colorful stuff in. But here's my actual, this is the winner. I did a quick systems-wide status check. I guess to set the scene, he's talking about himself here and his bodily state. I did a quick systems-wide status check, the results of which confirmed that my wagon was dragging. Plutonium chamber empty. Sleep required immediately. I took three steps toward my bed and collapsed face first into my vintage Star Wars bed sheets, where I fell immediately into a fitful sleep. Oh, vintage Star Wars bed sheets. And that, yes, by the way, as you referred earlier, that's the end of a chapter.
Yeah.
That's like, oh man, what's going to happen next? He fell face first into his vintage Star Wars sheets.
Oh, so yeah, his father's sheets. He's got on his own bed now. Sheets where, hey, you know, maybe he and his hot mom had been getting busy.
Oh, hey,
in there.
Now. Wow. Yeah.
You never, so yeah, then we had a new feature, the boring sentence of the week. And we had one here, that was submitted a lot of people wrote this in. It's also very dumb. So he's talking about the mission to hit him where they live. The icebreaker looked like what it was: a giant focused beam laser bolted to an orbital nuclear weapons platform. So that's, yeah, it wow. looked like what it was. Picture that. And it's hard to fathom that being written.
It's what he can only describe as, and then, yes, go on to describe it.
I think that's actually something Stephen King has, like, on Twitter has posted, like, never use that phrase, for what I can only describe as. And I think he objects to the phrase for a long moment. So we should keep an eye out for that as well throughout the book. That's one that doesn't rub me the wrong way, but that's something that I guess he is not a fan of. But my boring sentence of the week.
I thought you had your boring sentence of the week.
Oh yeah, I've got it. Here's the runner-up. For a few absurd seconds, I caught myself appreciating the attention to detail this dude had obviously put into his cosplay. That's close to for a long moment, actually.
Yeah,
it is. But the most boring of the week for me, there was a ton, because all that video game garbage was very hard to get through. But it came to me at the very end, where Ray is telling him why he thinks the alien ships are there. We think they're conducting surveillance on all of our hardline intranet nodes. So the aliens have traveled 7 light years in order to conduct surveillance on the hardline intranet nodes of planet Earth. And obviously there's some nefarious purpose there. If they shut down the internet, that wouldn't be a good thing. But boy, does it not sound interesting.
Wow. I have one last bonus sentence. This is doesn't relate to either the boring, really. This is talking about his, you know, don't do this kind of thing. Said, Ray was silent for what seemed like an eternity, but it may have only been a second. I just like when he loses confidence in his own dumbass cliches and then hedges his bets. Like, but it wasn't actually an eternity. He didn't actually stand there for the rest of all time. Yes. It may have only been a second. Look, stop misreporting me. It could have been either.
Right. And this had multiple times where he realized that he was the one saying something or realizing that he was gasping or something, which is another strange thing to gasp, disassociate yourself, and realize a few seconds later that it was you, something that no human has ever experienced. Right. All right. Well, I think that probably has gone on again for way too long for what this has warranted. But so, yeah, you're headed to London next week.
I am. I think one of the fanfic people said that they were looking forward to seeing me there. I think it's what he implied. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
Maybe they'll ask you to sign a copy of the book. yeah. And I'm headed to San Diego to see some old friends and our Riff Trax co-workers there.
Fantastic.
We should both be adding several degrees to our temperatures.
Yes.
But so, yeah, I don't think we'll be able to record next week because of all those trips. But if people out there want to read up to chapter 12, that'll be what we cover for next time. It is page 148. Are you going to be reading on your flight to Heathrow?
No. I procrastinate and then I cram. I read the whole thing last night.
Nice. Yeah, that's the way to do it. I'm not eager to sit down and read it again, but I don't know. You know what Kevin said he was going to be reading on the flight to Heathrow was The Pole Vault Championship of the Entire Universe by Conor LaStoca.
Oh, written by a real author.
Yes. Now available on Amazon and on Kindle. So if anyone wants to take a break, I would encourage you to pick that up because the Olympics are starting today and part of this book takes place there. So you can do some sports competition synergy.
Nice. Well, that's, I guess, what I'll be reading on the flight then, too.
Okay. So, yeah, read up to chapter 12, and we will skip next week and talk to you the week after.
All right. So long, everyone. This is 372 pages. We'll never get back.